final case of the day is Hung Quy against City of Elmhurst.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Dolores.
Counsel.
Sorry.
Ms. Pino.
Good morning. I'm Dolores Pino for the plaintiff appellants Hung Quy and Ri Yung Fei.
Once again, would you raise your voice, please, or get closer to the microphone, one or the other?
Sorry, Your Honor.
I'm an old man. I can't hear as well as I used to.
I represent the plaintiff appellants, Hung Quy and Ri Yung Fei, Dolores Pino, and we bring this appeal today requesting this court's reversal of the Honorable District Court's dismissal of the plaintiff's fourth amended complaint for failure to state a claim on the defendant's motions to dismiss. We bring this case specifically, it's a civil rights case, and I did focus our brief on count two of our complaint, the Section 1983 false arrest claim, and the Honorable District Court's probable cause determination, because we believe it was in violation of, importantly, the U.S. Supreme Court precedent of Francis versus Franklin, and this court's precedent, we bring it specifically on Olson versus Champaign County case, the qualified immunity case, both of those, as well as Illinois Supreme Court and appellate court precedent interpreting this deceptive practices statute, this bad check crime. We believe the Elmhurst police lacked probable cause to arrest Mr. Quy on these facts, on what happened to him, because of the intent element, the essential element of intent to defraud was not met on the facts that the police had at the time they arrested Mr. Quy, as well as on the essential element of what the check was to pay for in the statute for rental property. And the facts that the police had at the time they arrested Mr. Quy were they had a copy of the check when they knew that the check was for settlement of a civil lawsuit. That's in the arrest report. They had spoken to Mr. Carter, Mr. Quy's attorney, for the eviction court case. Mr. Carter told them that it was for settlement of a civil lawsuit case and it should be treated as such. That's in the arrest report. They had the check itself, and the memo line of the check stated that it's for settlement of that case to be dismissed, the memo line of the check. They also, Mr. Quy's statement upon arrest, that's in the complaint, and we submit that his statement at this stage of the case, just the complaint stage, should be taken as true under the governing standards. And the arresting officer put in the arrest report only the last part of his statement upon arrest, quote, she would not get it. Quy became upset saying that she would not get a dime, whereas his complete statement upon arrest, as in our amended complaint, is there was a settlement agreement between Lynn Kubitschek and me. If she did not do what she's supposed to do, she won't get a dime. So we believe that that shows that the arresting officers did materially alter Mr. Quy's statement upon arrest in order to insert intent to defraud where there was none, if his full statement upon arrest is looked at. We do believe that should have been credited as true at this stage of the case on a 12B6 dismissal motion. So we ask for the complaint to be, the Honorable District Court's decision dismissing the complaint to be reversed based on that, as well as It's a very important part about...
Counsel, the arrest in this case was authorized by a warrant. Your brief asserts that defendants made false representations to the state court, but you don't say which defendant or what representations they were. Where can we find evidence that particular people made particular false statements to get the warrant?
Based on Olson versus Champaign County, Your Honor.
I didn't ask about a case. I asked about the details of the record in this case.
In the arrest, in the investigation report, it talks...
I'm not asking about the investigation report. Presumably, if you say that false statements were made to the judge to get a warrant, you're dealing with statements in the affidavit made to get the warrant. So we would need to see the affidavit, and then we would need evidence that a particular statement there was false. But your brief doesn't even refer to the affidavit used to get the warrant.
We don't have that affidavit, and I investigated, Your Honor, and there's no record of the warrant hearing. So there was no... the evidence, the facts that the police...
Then I don't know how you can say, with a straight face, that false statements were made in something you've never seen. Now, surely you could have gotten the affidavit, but it's very difficult to say, so-and-so was lying, though I have no idea what so-and-so said.
We know that the police and the complaining witness, Lynn Kubitschek, were calling Mr. Kui and his family her tenants, but that is not, as a matter of law, possible because she had filed the eviction proceeding within a month after she purchased their house. They asked to become her tenants, but she refused, and the same day within a day or so, the allegation is that she issued a letter saying vacate the premises within 30 days, and within a month she filed the eviction case, and that those facts were easily ascertainable to the police the date the eviction case was filed. And the case law that I cited on page 10 of my reply brief, Murphy versus Texaco and the other two cases, as a matter of law, when an eviction is filed, a property owner is not entitled to rent. And the police were calling throughout their investigation report and their arrest report, they were calling this check rent, when as a matter of law, it is not possible that it was rent, qua rent, as Judge Shader said in the Murphy versus Texaco case. It was damages under the Illinois forcible entry and detainer statute, the eviction statute. And damages are allowed to be market rate rent type of damages for the new occupants of a property. I would like to point out a clear error of fact that the district court stated, which is we omitted the date that the eviction case was filed in our complaint, and I believe that contributed to the misreading by the Honorable District Court to assume a four-month-long landlord-tenant relationship when there was none. The district court's docket number 146 at pages 1 to 2 stated that Lynn Kubitschek filed the eviction case on June 7th, when actually that was the concluding date of the eviction proceedings, the date of the agreed order in question. So that was a clear error of law that probably led the district court to conclude that, help them misread this as a landlord-tenant relationship. And again, the case law, as a matter of law, once the eviction case was filed, it is not possible for the property owner to collect rent qua rent.
So, counsel, you're referencing page 2 of docket entry 146, which says, quote, she refused and filed an eviction case on June 7th, 2012.
Correct.
That's referencing paragraph 8 of the fourth amended complaint. What do you say that date should be?
The actual date that she filed the eviction court case was in March. It was within approximately 1 month after she purchased the house. So, and she had, we stated in the complaint that she, right away she issued a letter telling them to vacate the property, and they had 30 days to vacate the property. And we just omitted the eviction court case date, and I think that contributed to this error of law, as well as this violated, there was no, the memo line on the check said eviction court case. It was a lawsuit to settle a civil case.
Mm-hmm.
And
thank you, counsel. Mr. Acker.
May it please the court. I want to pick up on a question that you asked, Judge, as to where is it in the complaint that you talk about what was the false information given to the 18th Judicial Circuit to have this bad warrant issued? And, you know, to be quite honest with Your Honor, this has been a central problem that we've had in the litigation of this matter, given that there has never really been an acknowledgement or recognition that the actions taken by the Elmhurst officers arose by way of a judicially issued warrant. In fact, our understanding of the law of this circuit is that generally when you have an arrest warrant issued, you generally can't raise a false arrest claim. There's an exception to that where you show that the officer at the time that he's serving the warrant did not believe that there was probable cause. There's no allegations as to any of those matters in the complaint. We believe that those are materially significant and deficient, and as such, that those in of itself should lead to an affirmance of the district court's decision. We are a little concerned, Your Honor, about some of the representations as to the nature of what this dispute involves. There is a characterization that they are, this is just a payment for a settlement agreement, and that there really doesn't have anything to do with payment of rent. The Elmhurst, the appellees have submitted a motion for this court to take judicial notice of the actual certified copy of the agreed judgment order that was entered in the forcible case that's been taken with the case. And from the plain and ordinary meaning of the language contained in that agreed judgment order, it clearly says it's for rent. And so,
what difference does this make?
Well, it makes a difference, Your Honor. They're alleging that it can't be an attempt to set practice because it doesn't involve property; it involves settlement. And so, the issue that they're trying to chip away at,
if I understand Illinois law, paying a settlement with a check known to be false is itself an attempted deceptive practice. So what difference does it make what the check was for?
There is an element of the deceptive practice statute, Your Honor, that does that we're dealing with a subparagraph B that deals with that the payment is made for property, and that includes rental property. And so that's the battleground that we've been working with. And I don't disagree, Your Honor. I think it's, you know, in a certain level, kind of irrelevant. But on the other hand, you know, I had to wade through a bunch of pages of appellant's brief diffusing that when I really think that that's really not quite what we're dealing with. Having said that, Your Honor, there's a couple other issues that appellant's counsel raised, one of which is that there's some statement that was made by Mr. Quay upon the arrest that wasn't accurately reflected in the police report. And I think, I'm pretty sure that statements made after the arrest are irrelevant for purposes of determining probable cause. As such, those issues really shouldn't have any bearing on this court's determination. We really think that this is a very straightforward probable cause case, and we believe that there was certainly sufficient evidence to show, or pleading, by way of the pleadings, as well as the supplemental materials that were provided, showing the reasonableness of the Elmhurst officer's conduct. They didn't just accept Ms. Kubitschek's word for it. They did an investigation. They subpoenaed records from the bank. They obtained statements of showing that there was insufficient funds at the time that the checks were issued. They obtained records from the bank showing that there was notices sent to Mr. Quay following the attempted negotiation of the checks, showing that there was insufficient funds. There was evidence that there was a certified letter sent to Mr. Quay 6 months after these events asking him to pay the check, and that she was going to redeposit it, giving him notice of her intent to negotiate, attempt to negotiate it again, asking him to fund the account. She then goes ahead, after she receives a certified the certification back from the U.S. mail, saying that Mr. Quay had received it, and submits it again, and it's therefore denied. By the time that Elmhurst gets this in January of 2013, almost 7 months after the check was issued, we believe that the Elmhurst officers did their job, and they did it correctly. And by way of what they determined, they took it to 18th Judicial Circuit Court, they obtained a warrant, and they served it. And I think that there's really a pretty straightforward procedural, proximate cause. I'm so sorry. There's a very straightforward probable cause analysis, and we believe that it supports the district court's determination. For those reasons, we would request that this court affirm the district court's dismissal of this matter. If you have any further questions, I'd be glad to address them.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Acker. Mr. Ursuto.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much. I represent the Kubitscheks in this matter, and I won't recite. I think Mr. Acker did a great job of kind of posing our point, but I'll take one step further in that there was no settlement. This was an eviction. And the reason why he was evicted, because he wasn't paying rent. Then, for a settlement, there needs some consideration, meeting of the minds consideration. And there's some, here Mr. Cho had no leverage. He was being evicted. The court enters an order, which was agreed to by Mr. Cho, in that he's going to leave the premises, and he's going to pay my client $1,600, which was a month's rent, plus court costs of $258. What does he do then? He doesn't leave. My client then, and then he receives a check. Now, it's very important, as Illinois states, that under deceptive practices, when you issue, the deception takes place either when the check is issued or when it's delivered. At the time he issued the check, he knew there were not sufficient funds in his account to pay my client. When the check was delivered from his attorney to my client, there wasn't sufficient funds in the account to pay the check. So he did it on two occasions. This goes on for 6 months. My client tried to get the money. Going back and forth, he never funds the check. My client goes to the police. That's it. Then in his brief, he tries to make it a condition precedent that as a result of my client is supposed to give him a release and waiver, and then he'll fund the check. What, that never took place. That's not in the court order that we submitted. That wasn't agreed to. This was an eviction case. And if he wanted that term to be in there, he should have said the district court or the circuit court shall retain jurisdiction to enforce the settlement. He didn't put that in there. He knew the entire time he was being deceived. It was never his intent to pay my client. And as such, we would ask that all the evidence that has been presented clearly shows that it was never an intent to pay. My client went to the police. The police arrested him. And that's it. So for those reasons, Your Honor, I would respectfully request that you uphold the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.